It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios this morning, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to have you both back.
Yes, welcome
yes.
back.
Yeah, much better now.
Very good. Let's start out with local, and it looks like there's going to be a new sheriff in town, so to speak.
Well, no, actually, we keep the same sheriff, but we lose the police chief, Gil Kurlikowski, who has been Seattle Police Department's chief for the last 10 years, got tabbed this week by the Obama administration and becomes new drug czar. Which, from a national standpoint, is actually very good news. Kurlikowski has not been particularly known for his drug policies while Seattle's police chief, unlike his predecessor, Norm Stamper, who was an advocate for decriminalization of marijuana and a rethinking of the war on drugs when he was police chief, and has actually emerged since those days as one of the leading advocates in the country for rethinking the drug war. But Kurlikowski has did not campaign against I-75, the initiative that that passed a few years ago that made enforcement of the city's marijuana laws its lowest priority. When Tom Carr, the city attorney, campaigned vigorously against it, in fact those enforcements have dropped quite a bit. He has championed court diversions and treatment programs and a number of somewhat imaginative approaches to nonviolent offenders who get caught in the justice system. And basically, it is a very, very different approach than the ooh, oogie boogie boogie, drugs are bad, ooh, children be very scared approach of previous drug czars under both Bush and Clinton, and, you know, going all the way back to Nancy Reagan and just say no. So while you're not going to see the dismantling of the drug war anytime soon, for starters, there are just too many people getting too rich off of it, you are going to see, I think, a change in emphasis, and that's very good news. Now, in terms of being a police chief, Kurlikowski had a much more mixed record, particularly around issues like discipline of officers, in which he got involved in several different controversies for going too light on officers who got in various public troubles. There were a number of problems, particularly early on in his administration, with the shooting of unarmed suspects by police officers, which the King County still has a perfect inquest record of absolving every single law enforcement officer who has ever fatally shot an unarmed civilian. They've always been ruled as justified, which is just a remarkable statistic. The bigger concern at this point is who is going to be replacing Gil Kurlikowski as chief of Seattle Police. Now, that hire is made by Greg Nichols and then needs to be approved by city council. And, Nichols has distinguished himself, among other things, by essentially declaring a war on the poor in this city. The homeless sweeps that have happened, the densification and gentrification of the city of Seattle, and trying to make the city safe for that by prioritizing, not to put too fine a spin on it, but, driving poorer folks out of the city, either financially or, in the case of the homeless, quite often literally using the police. And it really makes you wonder what the law enforcement priorities are going to be that Greg Nichols uses to find a new chief, and whether that new chief is going to be as progressive in terms of things like community policing, in terms of things like dealing with the sort of frontline social service aspects of a policing job, which in a large urban American city, unfortunately, because of the loss of our safety net over the last 30 years, that's a lot of what frontline cops do now. It's a very worrisome idea that, number one, Greg Nichols will be bringing these sorts of priorities to picking the new police chief. And then, number two, you have Tim Burgess heading the law enforcement committee of the Seattle City Council, who will approve the hire. Burgess is a former cop who is You know, fairly thoughtful on some issues, but around law enforcement issues, also not likely to be exactly a progressive champion. And you certainly have not seen the Seattle City Council in general distinguish itself by standing up to Greg Nichols when he really wants somebody or he hires somebody that's not particularly appealing. So it's a very concerning time in terms of the future of the Seattle Police Department, particularly with a new union contract and various other pieces of the law enforcement puzzle also in play this year.
Yeah, and I see Kerlikowske's leaving the Seattle Police Department as having some positive aspects. In addition, I remember the militarization of the Seattle Police Force after the WTO was here in town, and I put that to Kerlikowske's credit, not to Stamper, since he was out very soon after the WTO. That was a troubling development. And
although, to be fair, don't blame that on WTO, because every single urban police department in the country has used different excuses to basically pursue the same
to
kind
do
of
that.
Policies.
Yes, but ultimately it is the police chief's decision.
No, I understand
to do that. And Kerlikowske went right along with that. Also, he introduced tasers, which are also a very troubling kind of thing for police to carry and can be very dangerous in certain situations. And also, he's refused to purge certain cops who have been found to be involved in police harassment issues and the abuse of suspects. And he's pretty much come down on the side of his officers rather than allowing any civilian oversight or any meaningful civilian oversight in the department. So those are some issues that need improvement. Also, there's the issue of the relationship between the Seattle Police Department and the minority communities in the city. I'm sure there are many folks who would like to see some improvement there as well. And these are all things that I'm not sure that Greg Nichols will even take into account when he's looking for someone to replace Kerlikowske. And I'm sure he'll probably be asking Kerlikowske for input on his replacement as well. So, but these are things that people should be bringing up and making a fuss about in the search for a new police chief.
Yeah, and when it comes to things like greater transparency and civilian oversight of the police department, there's been nothing but hostility from the Nichols administration over the past 8 years as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, news this week of the LNI Labor and Industries refunds going out.
Yeah, there's a program that the state has been operating over the past several years where LNI I don't want to say kicks back, because that implies there's something under the table and it's been very above board, refunds money to different industry associations around the LNI employment tax, and it turns out that they've been using the wrong formula to figure out their refunds, and they have been giving back too much money to some of these organizations, and the biggest beneficiary of that has been none other than the Building Industry Association of Washington, the extremely conservative, extremely politically active trade group that has, for example, poured a ton of illegal money into Dino Rossi's gubernatorial campaign, funded a number of regressive initiatives over the years, has been a real force for reactionary politics, shall we say, in the state over the past the past number of years. Well, it turns out that the BIAW has been doing that not only with state money, these champions of free enterprise capitalism who abhor any kind of government handouts. Not only have they been getting government handouts, but they've been getting too much. And now, if you and I had been getting, say, too much money on our unemployment benefits or whatnot, we would have to pay it back. Well, the BIAW is now fighting that and saying, no, we shouldn't have to pay it back. Some of the money has already been spent. Some of it they still have. But it really underscores, number one, that they've been trying to play by a different set of rules than what you and I operate under. But that, number two, they've been funding a number of these very charged, very partisan political campaigns with taxpayer money. And if this had been happening thing. On the left, if you had had, say, SEIU doing the same sort of thing, you can bet that people would be raising holy Hades about it. So it's really quite interesting that there hasn't been more controversy over this and over the BIAW's refusal to give the money back.
Yeah, I think it's also should also be a little bit controversial, the retroactive refund program itself. LNI, Labor and Industries, exists to make payments to employees, to people who are injured on the job. That's what LNI is for. And for years, people in the state of Washington who have suffered injuries on the job, particularly in industries where they're exposed to a lot of danger, like the construction industry, which is where the Building Industry Association of Washington comes into it, because they do pay a lot into the LNI fund because the construction industry tends to have a lot of workers injured on the job, and so their tax rate is higher than other industries and other employers in the state, but also places where workers are exposed to toxic chemicals, where farm workers are exposed to pesticides, etc. For years, injured workers have had trouble with LNI trying to get them to recognize that their injuries were on the job and that they deserve some kind of a payout for their medical conditions, particularly for chronic injuries that last a very long time. It can be difficult to get LNI to make payments to the workers. What LNI does with this retroactive refund program is they say, okay, certain businesses have a lower injury rate among their employees than other businesses in that same industry, so we will give them a refund of some of the taxes they pay. That's extremely controversial, I think. And I think if you're going to tax businesses, it should be the same. I don't think there should be a retroactive refund program. And in addition, I think there ought to be some kind of audit or inquiry into whether LNI actually tends to come down on the side of employees who are injured, or whether they tend to, as is more often the case, come down on the side of businesses who don't want their rates to increase. So that's at issue here as well.
All right. Moving on, finally on local, Mayor Greg Nichols, who you're just talking about, has a job creation plan.
Yes, it oddly enough, it's an election year, and even though nobody has really stepped forward to run against Greg Nichols yet, at least nobody who can raise the kind of money that'll be necessary to be competitive in a race against him, he's still running very hard, he's still raising money very hard, and so he was out in front this week on Wednesday announcing a job creation plan that doesn't actually create any jobs. What it does is it speeds up a few of the jobs by trying to move forward some of the already voter-approved infrastructure projects in the pipeline, such as the Pike Place upgrades that were approved by voters last November. But it did a few other things as part of that, too. Interestingly enough, the small business loans, for example, he wants to move forward the Mercer mess construction things, anticipating money from the stimulus plan that just passed Congress for that. And at the same time, also buried in the bottom of this notice was he wants to waive Stage 2 SEPA regulation. Now, SEPA is the state environmental program that requires that cities do environmental reviews of different projects, particularly if they're above a certain size, have a certain impact. And this is the third or fourth time that the Nichols administration has tried to weaken SEPA in one or another guise. And it really underscores the whole idea that Greg Nichols, who did not have any particular kind of record as an environmentalist or being concerned about environmental priorities when he was on King County Council before he became mayor, suddenly became this born-again environmentalist when he realized that he could use it to sell development programs and programs that were friendly to developers that have essentially enabled him to run twice now for re-election without any meaningful opposition because he has raised so much money. So what you've got is in a situation where instead of the argument, well, with climate change, we need more density idea, where you can at least in theory claim that your pro-developer agenda has environmental motivations. Here, the pro-developer agenda comes into direct conflict with environmental regulations that requires that that developers pay for studies that determine what kind of environmental impact your program is going to have. In the name of job creation, although it's not spelled out exactly what kind of jobs are going to be created, particularly since most construction right now is having difficulty getting finance because of the tight credit markets, which Nichols really can do nothing about, you have Nichols going and trying to waive environmental regulations instead. So it really does tell you a lot about just how deep Greg Nichols' environmental commitment actually is.
All right. Moving on to national and this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week the stimulus bill finally, a reconciled version of the economic stimulus bill, passed both the House and Senate. And it was a strictly partisan vote. Democrats largely supported it and Republicans largely didn't. And even after it became clear that the Republicans were not going to vote for the bill last week, and they were reconciling the bill and trying to cut some provisions from it to make it less expensive, the Democrats still could not buckle down and cut a lot of the tax credits and tax cuts that were added to the bill. I have to say, I want to see the study. I want to see the proof that tax cuts help in a down economy. There, as far as I know, there exists no proof. It's just simply a mantra that the Republicans repeat over and over again, and that the Democrats now apparently believe as well, that making one-third of this bill tax credits, you know, and to you and me, they're extremely minor tax, an extremely minor tax cut, is going to help. And, of course, included in this are some big tax credits for the wealthy. For example, for upper middle class and wealthy taxpayers, the AMT ceiling was raised, so fewer rich people will be subject to the alternative minimum tax. There are plenty of business tax cuts. In particular, if a business has annual revenue less than $15 million, which is a lot of businesses, and that's evidently the definition of a small business. It's not my definition of a small business, but it is theirs. Businesses with less than $15 million in revenue can carry back a net operating loss from, for example, 2008, if they had a big loss. They can carry it back 5 years and erase their profits for those 5 years and get a tax refund for those five profitable years before. So that's an enormous gift to businesses, an enormous gift of taxpayer money to businesses in all industries in the United States. In addition, they're allowing bonus depreciation for 2009, meaning it's an encouragement basically for businesses to buy a lot of computer equipment and other equipment, which they can write off in 2009. They don't have to spread out the write-off over several years. And I just want to point out that there's nobody who really can argue that creates jobs. That, again, is just a gift to businesses.
Yeah, and whether the businesses turn around and use that money to create jobs or, as is more likely, sit on that money or use it for other purposes
boost their dividend payments or pay executive bonuses or do stock buybacks or pay off debt. There's a lot of things that businesses would use that money for before they would use it for creating jobs in a down economy. So I just wanted to point that out. I also wanted to point out, too, that Obama had the opportunity when it became clear that Republicans were not going to get on board with this economic stimulus bill to stand up and really push for the things that he knows would create jobs and to cut out those things that wouldn't create jobs. And he really didn't do it. So I think we're getting a view of what he's going to be like as a president here. Unfortunately, some people argue, well, this is his first big bill to be passed. He's sort of learning on this one. And I have to say, yeah, it's unfortunate that the training wheels are on for this very important bill. But, if you're going to set a tone, you want to make sure that it's a strong one. And he hasn't done that.
And also an effective one. Mm-hmm. And the biggest problem with the stimulus bill as it is presently construed is it is not going to work nearly as well as it could have. And it's not at all clear, number one, whether the scale of it is even appropriate, whether or not we need to be spending double the amount of money that mm-hmm. we're spending. But even for the money that we are spending, you know, 30, 40, 50% of it isn't going to be doing the job that we want it to be doing.
Right, right. And this week as well, Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, announced a bank bailout plan that was shockingly vague, so bad that Wall Street plummeted immediately. The stock markets plummeted immediately after he announced it. From what I can tell, he's basically following in the footsteps of Henry Paulson, talking about a government-sponsored aggregator bank, or what you might have heard referred to as a bad bank, that would buy up mortgage-backed securities. In other words, he's looking at the crisis in there's really two ways you can look at this at the banking crisis. You can either think of it as a valuation problem. This is the way that Timothy Geithner and Henry Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, and banking executives want us to view the problem. They want us to see it as a problem of valuation, that investors are just panicked, they're not buying these mortgage-backed securities, hence those securities have no value. And then they say that what the government needs to do is step in and make a market for these securities by assigning a value to them and then starting to buy them up and giving private investors an incentive to do the same. However, most economists and a lot of investors, including some very savvy investors, view this not as a valuation problem. They view it as a problem of insolvency. And they're saying, look, investors are correctly valuing these assets at zero or near zero value, because what underlies them is an extremely shaky and weak housing market, a bad housing downturn that includes major credit problems for U.S. homeowners and consumers, which means that banks which have had extremely lax lending standards are now insolvent, and they're insolvent for a reason, and that's what's at the root of the problem. And we're talking about everyone from the IMF, who says that the banking industry is going to suffer more than $2 trillion in losses when this is all over, to some major investment managers who say, no, it's going to be upwards of $3 trillion or more in losses. It's an insolvency problem, not a valuation problem. And to fix an insolvency problem, what you have to do is, because none of these banks have effective board of directors, the government has to step in and seize the banks, purge out the CEOs and major executives who have created the problem, and they need to make shareholders and bondholders take the loss. Then they need to restructure the banks, maybe by selling off assets, the valuable assets, in order to pay for the losses, and spin off some of the units in these banks that are huge conglomerations of all kinds of different things. And then they need to re-regulate the industry. So far, the only thing that the Obama administration, that Timothy Geithner is willing to talk about in that kind of a situation, that kind of a plan, is the regulation piece. And the Obama administration hasn't even made any proposal as to what re-regulating the industry would look like. And so this is really why Wall Street responded by saying, you know, this is a horrible plan.
And this isn't just Maria saying these steps need to be taken. This is pretty much an industry-wide financial economic consensus at this point.
Yeah. This is everybody but the Obama administration. I mean, in his inauguration speech, he said the free market has to deal with the problem, and we believe the free market can. He was basically saying we're not going to nationalized banks. We're not going to do what needs to be done.
Yeah. By the way, Paul Krugman, in the spirit of TARP, had a new acronym for the bad bank, which was the Bad Asset Relief Fund.
Yes.
Barf.
Barf.
All right. Anything else on the economy?
No, that wraps up.
All right. Developments this week or perhaps not, in terms of extraordinary rendition?
Yeah, actually there was a very important development this week. This in a case that involves Jeppesen, the Boeing subsidiary that is basically the CIA's extraordinary rendition travel agency. They are being sued in the case of five rendees whose flights have been traced and were arranged by Jeppesen. There's a civil suit that the Bush administration had been blocking, claiming state secrets privilege. In other words, that the case could not even be heard because to do so would jeopardize national security. And this is an extremely broad reading of national security that had been used to excuse all sorts of crimes during the Bush administration, saying basically, yes, we're above the law, and not only were we above the law, but the law can't come down on us because to do so would endanger national security. The Obama administration has campaigned against this. Democrats in Congress have talked about passing legislation to close this loophole. But this week, in that particular case, the Justice Department, under Obama, came back and explicitly told the judge in this case, we are going to back all of the Bush administration's arguments in this. We are going to continue to invoke the state secrets privilege to try and block this case from moving forward. It's an extremely troubling development in terms of civil liberties for the Obama administration, particularly because the whole rationale of this is the idea that to talk about this program in open court would endanger national security because it would let the public know about this program when, number one, the program has already been reported on widely. Number two, there have been court proceedings in Sweden and other countries that have already in open court discussed this program. And number three, the Obama administration has already said it has abolished the program, so there should be nothing that it actually endangers. This in turn raises the question of whether the program's actually been abolished or not. So very, very troubling.
Yeah, it does endanger the consolidation of power in the executive, though. One of the things I was concerned about with a new administration is whether Obama and his crew would be able to go into a White House that over the past 8 years has seen a massive consolidation of power and accumulation of power to the executive and be able to say, wow, look at all this power. Well, let's give some of it back. And I don't think that's happening. I think this is a sign of that.
Yeah, and when we were talking about impeachment under George Bush, one of the arguments for that was the precedent that those crimes set, that would enable other administrations in the future, Democrat and Republican, to commit similar kind of abuses and cite the precedent. And we're now seeing that's exactly what's happening.
Right.
All right. On to international and Israel.
Yeah, Israeli elections last weekend. We still don't know the final outcome in terms of the exact number of seats between the leading party and the second leading party, between the center-right party and the right party. But the far-right party finished third, the Israeli Beitenu party of Avigdor Lieberman, which, I don't use this term very often because some people, some progressives just sort of, and people on the left just sort of throw it around willy-nilly, but I think it is technically accurate to describe Lieberman as a fascist, that he is, in fact, he's called for the eradication of the Palestinian people, among other things. And this now is the third most popular political party in Israel, more popular than the center-left Labor Party, which was the current government before the election. So a very, very troubling insight into the psyche of the Israeli electorate in the wake of the Gaza invasion last month. And that invasion had everything to do not only with the U.S. elections, but also the elections in Israel. And we saw during the Israeli campaign that questioning that invasion didn't even come up in the election, all the way across the political spectrum in Israel, which is unusual because usually there's more questioning of Israeli policy in Israel than there is in the United States. But it's a very hawkish mood in Israel right now. And that has all kinds of implications, for example, for what might happen with a possible Israeli or Israeli-U.S. attack on Iran.
And very briefly, Pakistan.
Yeah, we had another U.S. drone attack today, killing 20 people in Pakistan. And Dianne Feinstein, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, let slip in committee hearings this week that those drones are pilotless drones are actually being flown from a base in Pakistan, which was being kept secret from the American people, so that it could be kept secret from the Pakistani people, and that is likely to immensely complicate U.S.-Pakistani relations.
All right. And finally, events.
One event coming up this coming Thursday night at Town Hall, 7:30, Pratap Chatterjee of Corp Watch. Writings that he and investigative journalism that he has done on corporate depredations in America, and he will be in town, I believe, plugging his latest book, 7:30 next Thursday at Town Hall.
Yeah, latest book, Halliburton's War. So, all right, with that, talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
People can find Eat the State around town in places where you find other free periodicals, magazines, etc. And you can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org.